Today, Wall Street versus Main Street. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to Alex's Post, covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And today, I'm joined by George Gammon. Hello, George.
How's it going, Martin? It's good to see you.
Yeah, great. And we finally connect. There have been so many people on both our channels saying, you must talk to George. And so we've got there.
That's right. Yeah. I get those messages all the time. So I'm really super excited we could connect.
And what I think is interesting that both you and I have an intent of trying to educate and inform and help people to form views, right? To say, guys, there's a lot going on that you don't necessarily understand, but you need to understand because it's really important.
Absolutely. I mean, we could go on and on and on, especially right now with what's happening with the virus and the pandemic. It's just taking central planning to a whole new level. I mean, if we thought we were getting more and more central planning through what happened in 2008 with the, I'm just talking about from an American centric standpoint here, with the Fed doing quantitative easing, expanding their balance sheet to 4.5 trillion. And by the way, let's remember that that was supposed to be temporary. Remember when Bernanke came out and said that initially, he says, oh, nothing to see here. Don't worry about it. Move right along. Yes, we're doing 60 billion a month or 80 billion or whatever, but it doesn't matter. Because whenever we want to, we can just go ahead and reverse the cycle. We can unwind the balance sheet, no problem. And one thing I like that Schiff always talks about is he says in the beginning when they first started quantitative easing, it wasn't QE1. It was just QE because there wasn't supposed to be a QE2 or a QE3 or now a QE infinity. And it's just so my point there is the bigger the Fed's balance sheet gets, the more central planning we have, the more central planning we have, the less price discovery, we have, then the more dysfunctional and less dynamic of an economy we have. And that translates, or that trickles down, if you will, to the average Joe and Jane, because they have less opportunity, higher unemployment rate, and potentially a higher inflation rate, where their wages aren't going up, but the prices of what they buy at the grocery store is constantly going up.
Well, it's interesting because I've got this analogy of a black hole, right? And you know, the black hole basically sucks everything into it. And there's a thing called an event horizon, which is a sort of, the, you know, normal space versus the black hole. And it seems to me that the Fed is that black hole and it's sucking more and more and more stuff into its balance sheet, right? And, you know, they're basically sucking in equities, they're sucking in, you know, mortgage-backed securities. You know, if it moves, they'll buy it, right? But we should stop.
Well, as long as it's not in the real economy. As long as it's not in the real economy. Yeah, if you got a gas station on the corner, well, you're screwed. But if you're one of these massive corporations, like some airline or Boeing or something like that, then you're just getting money thrown at you. I did a video the other day on all these alphabet soup programs that they have. And I even left out a couple of them. And I had 9 on my dry erase board. And like 5 of the 9 were either explicitly or implicitly bailing out corporations.
Yeah. And if you look at the relative dollar value, right, not only is it the number of programs, but it's all concentrated on, you know, the financial system and corporations and, you know, even central banks overseas through the swap lines, who can then access corporates overseas. But if you look at the real economy, you know, and there are programs designed to help businesses and households, firstly, they have to go indirectly, so they go through a retail bank, right?
Right.
So the retail bank can get really, really cheap funds from the Fed, but that doesn't necessarily translate to what they actually provide to real households and real businesses.
Yeah, it's just another layer of bureaucracy for the subway or for the restaurant or the gas station or the construction company, where they have to go to their Wells Fargo or Bank of America or whoever their local bank is. And you just have to go through them first, and then you have to go through the Fed. So you have all these layers before you can actually get the funds you need. Where if you're one of these big corporations, all you need to do, I'm sure they've got the Fed on speed dial. Or, you know, or actually it's not even the Fed that's doing it. It's BlackRock. I mean, you want to really go down the rabbit hole. I mean, think about that. And I don't know if your viewers know who BlackRock is. They're basically a private equity firm, but they have a lot of these bond funds that they create and they manage. All right. Well, if you buy a BlackRock bond fund, there's certain assets under there. There's corporate debt that they've purchased that they think is the best corporate debt to have. Well, the Fed comes down and says, hey, BlackRock, here's $10 trillion or whatever it is. Here's a blank checkbook. Go ahead and buy the bonds that you think we should buy. Well, what are they going to buy? Of course, they're going to buy the debt that they own for their fund so they don't have to take a haircut. And by the way, not only are they getting this, what I would consider a bailout, or their investors are also getting a bailout, but then the Fed is actually paying them to do it. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. It's just total insanity. And the thing that really annoys me is the Fed, in my opinion, they purposely create this smoke and mirrors type thing. They come, you know, who's going to know what the primary dealer credit facility is? I mean, no one's going to really, other than just nerdy guys like you and I that really get into it and our viewers, but the average person on the street, they're not going to know what that is. So they don't know that the primary dealer credit facility equals the Fed backdoor potentially buying bonds and buying stocks, buying equities, because the primary dealers can buy them. And then the Fed can just kind of wink, wink, nod, take them off their balance sheet by giving them a loan that's 90 days, they can roll it over forever, and it doesn't really have any type of interest. And if the Fed's meeting them, you know, Jerome Powell's meeting with Jamie Dimon at lunch, saying, hey, listen, dude, we need you to buy like a couple $1 trillion worth of Apple shares. Obviously, I'm exaggerating the numbers, but we need you to buy, you know, this many billions of dollars of Apple shares and put them onto our balance sheet. Can you go ahead and hook that up? Oh, yeah, yeah, sure, sure, sure. No problem, no problem. And I think that's what's really happening behind the scenes. But my point is this smoke and mirrors and all this confusion with all this alphabet soup and all these technical wonky terms and esoteric language. It's just meant to confuse the average person so they don't realize what's happening. Because if they did realize what's happening while they're locked up at home trying to figure out how they're going to afford to put food on the table, or how they're going to keep their employees employed, or how their small business is going to survive, they just see these billions and trillions of dollars going to Wall Street again. They're going to go out to the streets with pitchforks, rightfully so. And unfortunately, I think the only way that we can combat this is just to make sure that we're educating people, all of our friends and family members, so they know what's really going on.
Yeah, it is important. And what I find is that so many people just are frankly not interested in these sorts of subjects, you know, prefer to watch a bit more Netflix and, you know, the next box set. Right. Because frankly, this is happening in real time, and this is real life, right? And of course, what's interesting about those loans that the Fed, there's no real recourse to them, is there?
On some of them, I think there technically is, but on a lot of them, there isn't. I think if my memory serves me right, that the TALF program, which is basically, according to the Fed, it's them giving excess or additional liquidity to investors. And I still haven't figured out who these investors are, but it's giving them loans to make sure that they're buying all of these securitized loans in the real economy. So you keep credit flowing for car loans, for student debt, for mortgages, credit card debt, all these things. Now, from what I understand, those loans are not recourse. It's all on the Fed's website. But I mean, to your point, is it really a loan if you can continually roll it over, if it's almost 0%, call it what, 5 basis points, and then it's non-recourse? And a lot of the loans going to the real economy, there's no recourse there, and they're not even looking at their income statement or the balance sheet. And listen, I'm all, if the corporations are going to get bailed out, obviously we need to take care of the small and mid-sized business, but there's just a lack of attention to detail, and there's so much red tape to do it. I think it's just going to turn out, although the intentions may be good, the net result is just going to be a big boondoggle where all this money just gets completely wasted. So if the taxpayer is having to pay a dollar, maybe two or three pennies of that dollar actually gets into the small and mid-sized business where it's intended to go.
Yeah, well, that's, of course, the issue. And there's a bit of moral hazard in there somewhere as well, isn't there, depending on precisely how things play out. But I guess my question to you then, George, is do you think the Fed has a playbook and is sort of, you know, effectively running the script, as it were? Or do you think they're just reacting to the different situations as they arrive and basically just, you know, doing this and then doing that and trying this and trying that? Where are you on that sort of spectrum?
Reactionary. Easy. They're just reacting. They're responding. I don't think they're ahead of the curve at all. I think if you look at their actions going back to the repo market September 17th, and if you read that report from Zoltan, and that came out, I think it was December 9th, where he said that they needed to really step up their programs. And then sure enough, on December 12th, you read the report on the New York Fed's website, and they're basically doing exactly what Zoltan said in his report. And I think they're combining just kind of that reactionary playbook with looking back at Japan and the ECB or just other central banks, because I think they use the same models. And I think the problem with the Fed's models is that it works on paper, but in real life, it's not going to play out. And there's going to be those unintended consequences, just like trying to tinker with nature. That's the way I see the economy. I see it a complex system with billions of transactions on a daily basis between individuals. And there's no way that a central planner can understand as much as the individual that's making that transaction, what's best for them and their family. And it's like that story here where they go into Florida and let's say they've got an insect problem. So they bring in some weird species of African frog. And the next thing you know, the frogs are completely overwhelming the whole entire state. And the frog problem is 10 times greater than the insect problem. So then what they do is they bring in some rare form of alligator. And then the alligator eats all the frogs, but then they start eating people and dogs and everything. And then you can't even go to a golf course because you get your leg bit off by an alligator if you hit your golf ball in the water. And it's just because nature is a complex system. So we as human beings just can't understand all of the variables. And if we do one little thing to it, we're going to mess it up even greater. We're going to have a bigger problem than we had to begin with. That's how I kind of see things. And that's why, for me, central planning just isn't a good idea, even if it alleviates some of the short-term pain and just tries to kind of kick the can down the road.
Well, it's interesting. And of course, it's worth reflecting on two things. Firstly, the Fed, of course, is privately owned by big banks, right? And secondly, the Fed and the ECB and, you know, the Bank of England and the Reserve Bank here in Australia, they all are sit around the table in the Bank for International Settlements, the Bankers' Bankers. So they've all got this groupthink about how to deal with the situation that they're facing. So in a way, they're not actually necessarily just thinking about it to, you know, objectively, independently. They've all got this same way of thinking about it.
Yeah, it's like this echo chamber. And even when they're not in their meetings, they're over at some swanky place in Aspen meeting or at Davos or something like that. And they're still just in their own little group just talking to each other. And that is not good. No matter what type of echo chamber you get into, it's you've got to get feedback from the outside or else you're going to start making some really bad decisions. And again, that goes back to why an economy that's decentralized and is a free market, bottoms-up approach is always going to perform better than a type of communism or central planning where, going back to the days of old-school Russia, where they're trying to decide how much steel should our steel manufacturer make. Well, we can kind of guess, but we don't know because there's not a price, right? If there was a price to the steel and the price of steel was going down, we would know, or the manufacturer would know, that, hey, I better lay off my steel production. Or if the steel is more expensive in Dallas than it is in San Francisco, okay, I need to divert more of my steel over to the area that that's more expensive, and that brings down the price. It's the input, the data and the information we get from prices is just totally invaluable. And it's not just about price discovery. And I think if people understood how important it was, they would understand how bad manipulating interest rates really are. Because if you're manipulating interest rates, then that's the half of, well, money is a half of every single transaction. So since interest rates are the price of money, basically what you're doing is you're manipulating the price of everything in the economy. So what is a house worth? Well, I don't know. If we have 0% interest rates or negative interest rate, you know, what's a can of Coke worth? What's a stock worth? What's a bond worth? What's my car worth? We don't have, it's like Jim Grant says, we're living in this hall of mirrors, and it does nothing but distorts not only financial assets, but the whole entire economy. So the longer we go with this growth of the financial economy that exists within this hall of mirrors, when eventually it's time to take the medicine or it's time to pay the fiddler, the worse it is.
So how do you think this is going to play out? You know, we are sitting, of course, in the middle of the virus at the moment, but let's assume that eases back. We've got this huge amount of debt in the system. The central bank is going to go on QE, QE, QE to the nth. So how does this all play out in your mind?
I think for the United States, it's a lot like the Bank of Japan, where they just keep buying assets, and they're going to be not only the lender of last resort, they're going to be the buyer of last resort. So you just gradually get more and more, whether it's equities, debt, it all goes onto the Fed's balance sheet. And then they can kind of determine who has to pay off that debt and who doesn't. Okay, if a large majority of mortgage holders are not able to pay their loan because of what's happening with the virus or XYZ recession, it doesn't really matter. Well, then they can just kind of let them not pay, and it doesn't really matter because it's not affecting the private sector. And I just see this gradual progression, just like they had in Japan. The only difference I see, though, although Japan has had a deflationary type of depression or just long, you know, lost decades, I think that I totally see that happening in the United States. But I also see a scenario where we could have a deflationary long-term depression, like a lost decade or two, but it's an inflationary depression instead of a deflationary depression. So when most people think of a depression, they just think of prices going down. But if you think of things in real terms, then it's very possible to have inflation going up, let's say at 5% per year, where nominal GDP growth is, let's say, 1% per year, and that would give you real negative GDP growth. So I see it potentially playing out that way. And I look at the U.S. housing market, and I always use a chart going back to 1900 adjusted for inflation. And there's a very specific trend line. It always tends to mean revert, which makes sense because generally home prices should be connected to wages, and wages should have something to do with inflation. So it makes sense that inflation has to do with housing prices. But you see it just really kind of just straight. And oddly enough, if you go all the way back to the late 1800s, you see that even where we were in the United States around 1998, 97, adjusted for inflation, and when you adjust for the size of the house, the prices are identical. 100 years, prices don't go up. And all of a sudden, we come in and the Fed, we had the dot-com bust. So the Fed says, okay, what asset bubble can we inflate to paper over the problem so no one has to feel any pain whatsoever? It's like we're living in a helicopter parent economy type thing, right? You can't let anyone feel pain. Everyone's got to get a participation trophy, even at the corporate level nowadays. So anyway, so they paper over that problem. So then you see housing prices really start to divert from that historic mean, and then they just hockey stick. I mean, straight up, they go parabolic until we get to 2006, And of course, we know what happens then. They come crashing all the way down. But where do they bottom out? They bottom out right at the historic trend line, 2012. And then, of course, they go all the way back up. Now, in a lot of markets, they're higher than where they were before. So I've done quite a few videos on the real estate market lately. And my takeaway from those videos, kind of my base case, is that I think prices will mean revert again, because they always have for the last 120 years or so. But I don't know that they come down in nominal terms. I think that the prices could go back to that historic trend line, but when you adjust for inflation. And I know, as an example, my sister called me up after she saw this video. She lives in Dallas. And she says, yeah, I mean, I totally get what you're saying in the video, but man, in Dallas and Texas, I mean, you have all these people moving here from California because of the high taxes. She goes, I just don't see home prices in Texas going down by 50%. I said, okay, let's go through just a quick thought experiment. So I said, do you think with what's going on with the virus that home prices in Texas could go down by 5% this year? She said, well, yeah, I think that's reasonable. I said, okay, do you see them potentially going down 5% per year for just 2 years, just the next 2 years while we're potentially dealing with the ramifications of the virus? She said, yep, I totally get it. I said, okay, great. So then do you think prices could be flat for the next 5 years after that, just in nominal terms? She says, yeah, I totally see that. I said, okay, well, the cycle in Japan, where they went from peak to trough in the 1990s, it took them, they went down by 60% or so, then they haven't really recovered too much. But that took 15 years. And even in the United States, it took about 6 years to get from the peak all the way to the bottom in 2012. So I said, okay, let's look at a 15-year cycle. So 2 years, we're down by 5% per year. Then we go flat nominally. And then for the next 8 years, let's say we go up by, let's just say 2 or 3% per year. I go, do you see that being realistic? She said, absolutely. Okay, great, we're making progress. Now, do you think that for the next 15 years, because of all the money printing and what the Fed's doing, and we potentially have MMT, helicopter money, do you see CPI going up to call it 5% for the next 15 years? She says, yeah, I totally see that. I said, well, what you've got is your home prices have gone down by 50% when you adjust for inflation. She's like, okay, I get it. So, but anyway, my point is that's kind of how I see it playing out. And I know you might have, and I'm open to being wrong. Listen, I almost flunked out of high school. I've never taken an econ class in my life. I'm just some schmuck on YouTube that does whiteboard videos and draws stick figures. So don't listen to me at all, but that's kind of how I see it playing out.
Very interesting, George. And look, I don't think that anybody quite knows, but I always say there's definitely an inflationary future and the deflationary future, and neither is actually good for real household and real businesses, unfortunately. The fact of the matter is we're going to end up with more centralized control, more effectively assets owned by central banks, the financial system probably looking pretty sparkly, but the real world and the real economy probably looking pretty dire for unfortunately for a long period of time. But the critical thing is people need to wake up, understand what's going on, and begin to actually react appropriately, because otherwise, it's all going to happen. George, I really appreciate your time today. It's been fantastic to catch up with you, and we should do this again because there's so many things I'd like to chat with you. But just before you go, where can people find out more about you?
They can just go to my YouTube channel, or they can find me on Twitter. It's just my name, George, typical spelling, and then Gammon is my last name. It's G-A-M-M-O-N.
Great. George, I appreciate your time today, and let's catch up again soon.
Thanks, Martin. I appreciate it.
Cheers. Take care.